Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our audiences online and on the radio. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce both John King, the architectural critic, and Pierluigi Seriano, an architect and the writer of the book, The Creative Architect. It's a great look back on research that was done in the 1940s with all the top architects that kind of never really, there were some short essays published, but most of it didn't really come out. So he went back, went over it, found out what they had done, and John King is going to be interviewing him, and he'll introduce Pierluigi.
Okay, thank you all for being here. Since he turned off your phones, you will be in suspense about the Giants game until the end of the talk. So Pierluigi and I will have a discussion for about 40 or 45 minutes. We'll leave some time for questions. He also has some tapes from the interview at the time, so that'll be kind of fun. But I just want to start by saying that as somebody who writes about architecture and urban design and the fabric of the Bay Area and just kind of the changing landscape we have here, the work that Pierluigi has done is just a remarkable resource that I don't think the Bay Area can possibly appreciate. Essentially, what he has done, especially with the book NorCal Modernism that came out a decade or so ago, is look at really the fine grain of the architectural world here and just capture these very good architects who worked in the mid-century, before, afterwards, and really created a lot of what's around us and what's being torn down around us in some cases, and just capturing the work that they did, the architectural photography of the time, which is a wonderful primary source in itself, and then also just kind of what fueled them and how they thought about these issues. And it's of real value. And we'll get into this in the conversation. Architecture is something that, like a lot of trades, the top few percent of practitioners are looked at and looked at and looked at. And then there's the mass that does the regular work. But the regular work itself involves very good, very influential work. And what Pierluigi has written about, whether it's that or he did a great book on Donald Olson, who was a UC Berkeley professor who did not very much at all. But what he did at the time in the mid-century was some of the most acclaimed work within the Bay Area. And by caring about these people, focusing on them, talking to them while they're still alive, not that you can do otherwise, except with a Ouija board. you know, he has really preserved something that I dip into for pieces, but I think you're going to see it on and on and on. And that's certainly the case with the current book that came out this year, The Creative Architect, Inside the Great Mid-Century Personality Study, which kind of sums it up, and it's a remarkable test that kind of seems crazy today, but in the aftermath of World War II, maybe wasn't so crazy. And that was the notion of academics and researchers that we can define essential human values, in this case, creativity. And why not pull together the best architects in the country, bring them together for a few weekends, and figure out what makes them tick. And it's something I had never heard about, and then Pierluigi does this book that's just, it's a fascinating book. I know it's on sale, and I recommend that you buy it, or at the very least, look at it at the library. But we're going to talk a bit about how the book came to be, about some of the details in it, and then a little bit about, was this study and were the subjects aberrations of the time, or are there lessons for today? So I just want to start by thanking you for letting me sit up here.
Thank you, John.
And one of the interesting things about the book, which is just kind of mentioned in passing in either the foreword or the acknowledgments, is how the book came to be, which was very much a chance encounter. So if you could maybe describe how it is you came to know about the study and then know that the resources still existed.
Yeah, so there were three separate circumstances that made me aware that the book, well, that the material was there. One was an article by Paul Goldberger in The New Yorker. He used to write a column called Skyline that Louis Mumford used to write in the old days. And I remember him mentioning Philip Johnson sharing with him that he was part of this creativity study in Berkeley. And I never knew anything about it. Nobody had ever talked about it in Berkeley. So I was wondering where the study had gone. The second opportunity or entry point was that when I was doing Norcal Mod, I interviewed at length Don Olson, who was this architect that was one of the designers of Worcester Hall, but he had a long pedigree of work with Eero Saarinen and Worcester, and even Bobansch, but studied with Gropius. And so he was one of the panelists that picked the architects to be part of the study. And I just realized that the study was a real thing, that there were people and there was a process, but I did not know where the files were. And then through a very chance encounter at the Oakland airport, I ran into Raymond Neutra, the third son of Richard Neutra, the great architect, who told me, I found the files of my father, and I think you should look at them. And, you know, coming from the children, because this is very sensitive material, but Raymond is a wonderful friend, has been extraordinarily supportive, but he's also, you know, it was a statement of trust that I was going to handle this material with care, because there was a lot of personal information that wasn't necessarily relevant to the book, although great costly material.
So how did you approach the institute at Berkeley that now has them and explain, I want to dig through your files and it'll be okay?
Well, it started through Raymond, who gave me access to Wallace Hall, who was the right-hand man of Donald McKinnon, the head of IPAR, that was involved in the study, and he was very frail, and I spoke with him over the phone. He said they wanted to do a book, but the book never came to fruition, and the files were in Richmond. And I believe Waverly Lowell also helped me from the Environmental Design Archive to have access to them. I don't really have a linear process. I do remember that at some point, an individual whom I'm very grateful, Elizabeth Peel, the sort of person, the go-to person for anything that has to do with IPAR, let me in slowly but consistently into her life, and she had the keys to the archives, and we went innumerable times in Richmond. I mean, innumerable times, because it's many file cabinets. And the architect study is only one study among many other studies that were done.
And a last question on just kind of tackling the material. Did you know from Richard Neutra's son what to expect? Or were you, and if you look at the book, you'll see there are just, I mean, literally doodles. How many drawings can you do in 10 minutes or whatever? Like kind of paragraphs from short stories. I mean, it's a very odd assemblage. I mean, did you know in detail?
No,
or you
I
just
didn't.
Kept going through the
I
file?
I didn't. I simply, the first inkling that this was more than a set of interviews was when I realized who participated into the study. So Raymond looked at the files of his father that essentially were transcripts of his interview, life history, his origins, childhood, which was a really interesting exercise. And then there was one question that really hit me, and that was part of a template that all the architects were asked for. And the question was, what is your contribution to modern architecture? And the architects themselves say what their contribution is, which is astonishing. And it's astonishing that this question is looked back at them and they already see themselves inscribed in modern architecture, in the history of it. And so they can say what their real input is. And so Kahn and Howard Hamilton Harris, it's really the caliber of the architects that was astonishing.
And that's one thing that fascinated me is that the first section of the book the introduction kind of captures some of the invitations. And so it's like there's the letter to Mies van der Rohe and there's Mies's response and things like that. And, in some ways it was a world very much like today with the certain bright stars shining in the sky. But it was also, I remember one who I think couldn't make it because of too much work, but he said, my gosh, the idea of spending a weekend with fellow architects, I can't imagine anything better. You know, it's not like today where you could Skype and email and text and do all these things. It was the 50s. Could you describe for me or for us a little bit about how this selection was made and then the structure of the test?
Yes, before answering that question very briefly, that letter was written by Marcel Breuer, okay, who had been invited to be part of the study. The selection process was a book in and of itself, because the primary question is, how do you establish who is the most creative? What are the criteria? And in a way, this imperfect science led to some assumptions. Primarily, it was these five panelists, Don Olson. Well, William Worcester had been approached by Don McKinnon, the head of IPAR, to help IPAR.
And he was head of the
Institute of Personality
School of Design
Assessment
at the time. No, no, but
William Worcester. Yes. William Worcester was the dean of Berkeley from 1950 to 1963. The architect study took place between 1958 and 1959. And it took place after the writer's study. And the writer's study had Truman Capote among the people that attended. These were people that actually were flown to Berkeley for 3 days and subjected to 22 hours of tests, and they were staying at the Claremont Hotel. It was all very organized.
Well, why not describe what the weekend was like? And we'll go back to the selection process.
Sure. The weekend, they would arrive around 12 o'clock. There would be a meet and greet, and in a matter of 15 minutes, they would start their tests right away. I mean, there was not even an easy transition. And the tests were structured, but there were also unstructured analysis of their behavior. So how they were, talking to each other, the way they were, having their cocktails. There was a level of policing that was astonishing to themselves. They didn't realize that they were being studied while it was happening, but they told that that was the case. And then the researchers did that. So it was all very, very analog, obviously, with the notebooks, but extremely intense. So McKinnon wrote in the letters of invitation, beware, this is not going to be a relaxing weekend in Berkeley. And, then they were flying back to where they were coming from. I would say a third of the architects were from the Bay Area, but many of them were from New York, Boston, Chicago. So it was a long flight. What I found that was really amazing to me was that why would someone like Eero Saarinen, at the top of his fame, after having done the General Motor Technical Center, after having all these projects that he was being doing, Philip Johnson had done the Seagram Building, why would they go to Berkeley for 3 days to draw doodles? I mean, it's there's something odd about this. And to a large extent, the primary driver was socializing in an environment of people that were probably going to lead to more jobs, either because they were going to be client representatives for governmental institutions at the time. I remember I found some correspondence about who was going to be certain American embassies, and they decided Victor Landi was going to be doing the embassies, I think, in Colombia or something like that. You know, Victor Landi was only 36 years old. So they were, you know, in a kind of a clubby fashion, strengthening their alliances. Worcester was an extremely strong political figure. And Saarinen had a very weak spot for Finnish architects. I mean, Alvar Aalto, who was evaluated.
Well, that's the thing, because it wasn't like kind of the Berkeley professors had their opinions, but then also reached out to some editors of publications to draw up their list, come up with a list, and then start in-house critiques of that list.
Yeah, the sixth official member of the committee was Elizabeth Kendall Thompson, and she was the West Coast editor of Architectural Record from 1947 to 1975. And she also organized a famous exhibit of the Bay Region domestic at the San Francisco Museum of Art that introduced the Bay Region style as a concept. There was no Bay Region style prior to 1949. And just as it's an important aside, but I want to reiterate this, the very first exhibit that the New York Museum of Modern Art did on modern architecture in the United States, called Building USA 1932-1944, has the Heckendorf House by John Funk in Modesto. So why would you have a house in Modesto when you have so much work? Schindler, Neutra, right? They pick a house in Modesto. So Northern California and Southern California were accounted as one cultural entity. And so the division came through the Bay Region side, and she was instrumental in that. So although she's not given an official role, she's all over the selection process. She constantly counsels McKinnon, because McKinnon had no clue about architecture. It was obvious. And so he needed to lean on experts, and she was the expert constantly available. And she was deeply interested in the subject, an extremely brilliant woman, a great writer, I would say the Ada Louise Huxtable of the Bay Area.
And it's interesting in the book, you get, it includes some of the, you know, the Joseph Escherich, William Worcester, some of the others, you know, they were critiquing all these finalists, so to speak. And for instance, I think it was Escherich, I'm not sure if it's Escherich or Worcester, was saying for Philip Johnson that he was like a disciple of Mies van der Rohe to the point of bearing the stigmata. And Joseph Escherich talked about wrote about Paul Rudolph in the little card, that he was kind of a really good drawer in things, but his actual buildings lack any real human quality or human scale. You know, so it's just this real fascinating look at how dismissive and how succinct, we'll put it politely, people could be. I mean, how did you decide, you know, they're winnowing out. How did you figure out what to winnow out for the book?
Well,
because that's the fun stuff, is going through all the gossip.
Exactly. I mean, there is a, I feel compelled to say this book would have never been written the way it is 60 years ago. Had they known what other people had talked about each other, how they talked about each other, they would have never spoken to each other again. So these were people that were being evaluated independently. These five evaluators, Worcester, Vernon DeMar, Joe Escherich, Don Olson, and a young faculty, Philip Thiel, were given a list of architects to choose from, a list that they put together. And individually, separately, they were to fill out these questionnaires, rate them, and put some comments. And so you really understand why Berkeley went the way it went, who were the favorite architects, who were those that were, you know, voted off paradise. And there was an amazing evaluation of Alvar Aalto, because Alvar Aalto was involved in the MIT dorms at the time. So even though you didn't have to be necessarily an American architect, you had to be in the United States at the time of the experiment. They could have picked Le Corbusier, for that matter, had he had a project at that time. So they invited everybody. Everybody that meant something in the world of architecture. And in that respect, the criteria for having them come is whether they would accept or not. So they started from the architect that got the highest marks, which was Frank Lloyd Wright, obviously. And then the second was Mies van der Rohe. And the third was Eero Saarinen. So it was not that bad that they got Saarinen. But Saarinen accepted at the very last minute. And right after that, Johnson accepted at the very last minute, because Johnson is a perfect case of someone who lives in the limelight. But as he wrote, as he was fitting on many of the tests, there was especially one test called the Fire Bee test. He was profoundly unwilling to socialize. He did not want to be in any groups. He remarked himself, I would just want to be alone, constantly alone. You always put the marked it, extreme boxes. And then you see he's so gregarious in these tapes and the way he talks and the kind of media personality.
And then the architects were also asked to rate each other.
Yes. And that was hysterical, because they did it themselves, because they signed their name. So you know that they did it. They signed their name, they dated it, the place where they did it. And 33 out of the 40 architects rated themselves. I could not find those of Neutra and George Nelson. George Nelson said, I'm not going to do it. I cannot do this. Ernst Born said... who is an architect from the Bay Area, said it's the hardest thing that I had to do. But others, just jump right in.
And a number of them didn't have to look far to see who the best architect was.
Yes. There were lots of number ones. But some people, it was wonderful. I was able to reach Victor Lundy. There are only two architects alive of those 40. Ian Pei, who I understand is in declining health, and he's also almost 100 years old, and then Victor Lundy, who is 92. So I sent the ranks to Victor Lundy, who lives in Houston, and I called him, and we had a great time. He couldn't believe that Philip Johnson was rated so highly. By so many people. Come on. He said, come on. Everybody knew he wasn't a good designer, even by his own admission. But it shows you how skilled it was as a cultural activator in organizing and steer the energy of a particular cultural information, which was the cultural modernity. And I think that's his really... timeless contribution to 20th century.
Now,
America.
Did Lundy also tell you, so there were, kind of fill out the blank test or fill in the doodle test. There were also some tests in controlled settings. Did he tell you about the one of people kind of peeking at other papers? And
yes, it was a conformity test.
Yes.
He told me.
Not officially billed as a conformity test.
No, it was, the idea... The principle behind this test is whether or not you hold on to your intuition about a problem concerning a response to something, or you let others influence you and then you change the response. So there were five machines that were in line, and people were in cubicles. They could not see each other. And there was a researcher that could manipulate the answers of the others. Let's say that Saarinen was in the booth and there were four others. Let's say there was Wernicke and there was Lundy and two others. And then Saarinen would see that Lundy was giving a certain response about a particular segment. This segment is going to be 3 feet. And Saarinen knew that this could not be 3 feet. It had to be 1 foot. It's beyond reasonable doubt. But then there are others that start thinking, is it 3 feet or is it 1 foot? And so Lundy saw Wernicke change his answer. that I couldn't believe he was doing it. It was very funny. That's the layer that I miss very much about talking to all the others. I actually met Mario Ciampi, who was part of the study, and Wernicke, but we didn't talk about this, and Warren Callister. And Jack Kilmer told me that he had participated to this study. I learned from the daughter of Fred Langhorst. Fred Langhorst was a Taliesin fellow. He stamped the drawings of the Morris shop in San Francisco by Lot Wright, that he came home one day and he said, her dad said, they asked me where to put a third arm. I had no idea. What kind of questions are those? So some of the quirks of the test stayed in the family.
And was the driving purpose of the test to learn about architects and architecture, or was it more this broader, what makes the creative soul different from standard people?
So architects embodied both the scientific knowledge and the artistic knowledge. This is very broadly. They identified three types, the strictly artistic type, the scientist type, and then this hybrid. And they put into the hybrid the architect and the mathematician. So they studied mathematicians as well. As they studied, you know, the members of the expedition on Mount Everest. They studied Irish managers. They studied early engineers of Silicon Valley. So they did decades of study. So the architects was one. It wasn't necessarily about architecture, but the processes that architects were going through to tackle issues, how their decision-making process and how their personality was shaped. And so in that respect, they realized that many of the traits of the architects were consistent with the traits of other creators in other fields. But it seemed to be, there was a kind of a meta layer for the creators.
Because this also seemed to fit into the larger fabric of society at the time, that there was kind of a certain set order, and through psychology or psychoanalysis, you could kind of define these things. And I mean, that was an impression I had.
Well, the great daring proposition of the Institute of Personality Assessment and Research was that creativity was knowable and was measurable, that you could actually, you know, with quote unquote with a tape measure, identify and therefore quantify through metrics who the creatives were. So that alone was a leap of faith. You know, it's also tremendous faith in science, a faith that we don't have necessarily today. I mean, there's a lot of doubt to that. But the fact that both the participants participated at that caliber and the researchers engaged into the work, and they got all the funding from the Carnegie Corporation, it means that society was very ready to absorb that kind of
message. And it was written about in Look magazine or Life magazine?
It was written intermittently.
But I mean, in other words, the general media took this.
Yes,
topic.
The general media took it, but they were no, unless the characters identified themselves, IPAR was very diligent about not revealing their names. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, when the book came out, I got some emails and someone wrote to me, maybe he wrote to both of us. It was after the review of the book or the piece that you wrote. He said that it was a student of McKinnon, and up until 1981, he had not revealed who the architects were, which is really interesting. The architects did not say, you know, that they were part of the study.
Now, you also have some tapes, which, you know, back in the 50s, it would have been a big reel of spool of tape this big, but you've got it.
Yes,
on your computer.
So something that I wanted to share, besides correspondence tests, the construction of the experiment, the results, what was really fascinating was to find the reels with the recordings of the architects having these group discussions. So there were two group discussions. One was the ethics problem, That was the third art problem. So I'm going to play three segments from a group that had George Nelson. You probably, if you don't know who George Nelson is, you certainly have seen his furniture everywhere to this day. And Serge Chermayev, who was a very, very good architect, whose claim of fame was this project that he did with Eric Mendelssohn in England called the Delaware Pavilion, and then he taught at Yale. And there was Howard Hamilton Harris. And
who did the house above the campus.
Yes, the Weston Havens house, an extraordinary house, and two more folks. So I'm going to play the ethics problem from how it is, and then two answers between Chermayev and Nelson. Yeah.
And while Pierre Luigi gets this set up, I should mention the really good Roman Mars 99% podcast had an episode on the creativity study and everything that also has some of the excerpts. So if this whets your appetite, you can rush home and pop it into your iPhone.
They're going to be like a minute each.
Gentlemen,
they were actually having martinis.
I don't think that'll pick it up, do you?
I think the ice click will just.
For the next 30 minutes, we would like to hear your views about a problem that, although hypothetical, embodies some issues important for architects as well as those in many other fields. I'll read the problem to you and ask you to first indicate your personal reaction on a slip of paper. Then we'd like you to discuss the issue candidly among yourselves and reach a joint conclusion at the end of the 30-minute period. Here is the problem. Mr. Brown is faced with a difficult decision. He has just finished the preliminary drawings for a very challenging and important structure. His client has told him that he likes Mr. Brown's proposal very much and will accept it if he will change one fairly important aspect of the design. The client would like it altered in a specific way. Brown has tried as hard as he can to persuade his client to his point of view, but to no avail. His client still feels strongly about it and tells Brown that while he is very pleased with his design, he will have to reject it if the change is not made. Brown's sense of architectural quality is greatly disturbed by the alteration his client demands. Most of what he feels about visual form, design, function, and beauty would be violated if the design were changed. On the other hand, the commission is highly prized, since it is to be an interesting, challenging, and a prominent structure. He feels that in addition to being an architect, he is in business and has a clear obligation to please his client, since after all, the client is paying for the structure and he'll have to live with it. And as a practical matter, he has a responsibility to support himself and those who depend upon him. As he's weighing these factors, the phone rings and the client asks for his answer. If you were Brown, what would you do? Now, I'd like you to answer.
Okay, so and they have to reach a joint conclusion. When these are five profound individualists. So it's practically a boxing match. And so I'm gonna play the answer of Chermayev. Now, the son of Sir Chermayev, Ivan Chermayev, is a world-famous graphic designer. He designed the logo of Chase Bank, and you probably have seen many of his work. And so anyway, Sir Chermayev was a great teacher, a great architect, also a fabulous writer. So we'll see what he says in a moment. So he's asking John Funk.
Oh, I was wishy-washy. I said I wasn't certain, but I'd probably reject the commission.
Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. I was unequivocal about it.
You said no.
Yeah, I would say no, but I would at the same time follow it up by recommending him a flexible architect. Actually,
you put that down?
Yeah. Oh, okay. See, I really think the this year's here is a very interesting one. Don't you think? The fact really is, who do you think you are? You see, and I think I'm the kind of architect people come to because I'm going to give them what I do and not what they want. If you are, on the other hand, in business, that's another thing. You see, I'm just not in that business. This is simply an arrogant
you
man are speaking.
Because you're on a university payroll, and it wouldn't matter.
And he has tenure.
Yeah, that's why I gave up practice, you see, because one was constantly faced with this kind of silly problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and, life's too short.
George? Well, I marked 5, which I think was probably give it up. And the reason for the probably was that the problem as stated was a kind of probably, too, because you don't really know from the statement of the problem how seriously this one item would affect the whole thing. You get the impression that Brown's client is a rather arbitrary and unreasonable guy, but you know, you're not quite sure. In a real life situation, by which I mean you had more data, you would know whether this one requirement was reasonable or not. But the general impression I had was that the client was being a damn nuisance.
Yes, an unreasonable
guy. And you probably would do well to get
part of it. This is what I feel the thing.
But only probably because you don't know exactly what he is up to.
Okay, so the client is a damn nuisance. We've got to get rid of him.
Which I'm sure architects still say today.
Yes. Yeah. There was one final piece still by Shermayev. But you get a general sense. I mean, the phrasing might be a little different, but there's consensus on what to do next. So this is Shermayev again.
And just being satisfied every step of the way, or get out while the getting is good.
Yeah, I think this is really the fundamental issue. And I think that you're all correct. You see, you're practitioners. I find myself in a very peculiar corner. I'm alone here. You see, I'm just not involved in clients at the moment. If I were, however, I would make an absolute ultimatum in a very sort of minor, Frank Lloyd Wright-ish way, you see, that he is in fact to go to Miami and I don't want to hear from him until the smoke is coming out of the chimney. If it were not so, I just wouldn't take the job, because I know all the horrors of the client's wife's notion about pink or whatever, you know, and I'm just not going to get into it ever again, because it's not an architectural problem. As a matter of fact, it's a dull problem. It's a dull problem to satisfy a man's taste or a woman's taste. And the only interesting thing, I think, in the case of a commission which is really architectural, is to solve a problem. And the client is just as viable in interfering with that, you see, as a railroad track.
All of which brings...
So that gives you the gist of...
And one last question on the tests, and then a wrap-up question, sure. And then we'll open for questions from the audience. There was also one-on-one interviews with the architects that was very much the equivalent of the psychologist's couch.
Correct.
Okay, if you could just describe that.
Yeah, it was about 2 to 2.5 hours of interviews that the researcher was performing on the architect, and the sections that were being asked were about life history, surroundings, education, early experiences, and then college, how education came about, what brought the interest to them in what they were doing. And then it was about their understanding of architecture, their role, their resolve, you know, how they deal with situations of this nature. What was really fascinating as an added piece to the interview was that the researcher was describing the architect arriving into the scene. So there were 4 to 5 researchers that interviewed the architects total. And one was Sarnoff Mednick, who invented the remote association test. And Mednick interviewed Neutra, interviewed Soriano, and several others. And then William Schultz was the other one. Schultz invented the FIREB test and a number of other important tests. These were young researchers on their way to their own fame. So it was a really fantastic intersection of personalities. But, you know, they discuss how Kahn arrives. He arrives into the scene. He's very jovial. He's very cooperative. He sits down. He starts. He has no hesitation, blah, blah, blah. And instead, Philip Johnson feels like a lion in a cage. He does not want to be there. He does not want to cooperate. He's just, he has to talk, but he doesn't want to talk.
And then another talked about beatings by his father and seeing his mother and father make love.
Rafael Soriano was the most theatrical. And actually, it was really interesting because Sarnoff Mednick interviews Soriano. Soriano had been an intern with apprentice with Neutra. So Neutra, they both came with a super strong personality, but completely different types of pathologies. because that's the one thing that became clear to the hyper folks is that creativity has an inherent element of pathology to it. There's a restlessness that this creative has where they simply cannot sit still and just take reality as it is. There's something within themselves that is engaged, and they get involved in this very intense quest to resolve the issues on their own terms. And this is not for the architects, this is across the board. So that's something that, you know, you might question the validity of the tests, but they all have the same type of errors. And they interviewed about 5,000 people in total. 1,500 actually came to Berkeley. Others were through interviews only. Then there was follow-up studies. The follow-up study of the architects, there were two of them, confirmed the same results, same level of intensity, same kind of focus.
And the interviews, those were not taped, but you have the you know, the writing down afterwards, including the judgments of the basic personalities. And Philip Johnson was described as a controlled psychotic. Let me go and see if there are any questions on the floor. And okay, great.
I'd like to remind our audiences that they're listening to the architectural critic John King interviewing Pierluigi Soriano about his book, The Creative Architect. And as John just said, it's time for questions. One thing that you brought up about, you know, architects thinking that their clients are a damn nuisance, I was just wondering if that's why Ayn Rand picked an architect as her character for this. You know, because that was an unusual choice, I thought, but it sounds like maybe it was right up the line.
I was sharing this with John. I went through 32 hours of unabridged audiobook of Fountain last week. I decided to go through it, and I realized that the ethics problem is literally drawn from the Ayn Rand's book, because there's a scene of Howard Roark, the architect, is presented with a 50-story building that he has designed. He's crazy about it. He's totally modernist. But then the client says, oh, we are ready to go, ready to sign. However, we have the son of a patron here is studying architecture. He's decided to dress up a little bit the building, just a minor change. But, you know, once we do that, we're ready to go. And then Howard Roark walks away. So, you know, they extended the narrative, but that is the ethics problem.
It sounded familiar.
And there was a woman.
Oh. And a follow-on question. Was there any of those 40 architects that actually was willing to work with the client on that question?
Yes, there was two architects seemed to be willing more than anybody else to work with the client. Howard Hamilton Harris, in fact, in this tape, he says, I think I got the job. No one wants his job. And the other one was Don Emmons of Worcester, Bernardi and Emmons. And he said, I don't think we understood the client. I cannot believe that we could let a situation like this slip to this point, which is what Nelson essentially said. No, there's something artificial about it. How can you get to this point where everybody's happy until this one little thing that is going to make everything disintegrate? So,
next question.
You had mentioned that there was faith back then and there's doubt now. Can you expand on that?
Well, faith in the scientific method, faith in science, the whatever was coming out from scientific literature was the absolute truth. The person that started, even within the Arctic study, questioning that authority was actually Philip Johnson. And he said, you know, what are the instruments that you're using to really study us? And he was very insistent about it. And although they had some methods, the researchers themselves said, we don't really have a way to fully, unequivocally nail the issue of creativity. I mean, there's a tension towards studying it. There's a set of procedures that we can use, but it's not mathematics. So when I talk about the doubt now is that with the rise of science studies, now it's about 20 years old, in the work of Bruno Latour, the authority of the lab has been completely put into question. Because in the end, the researchers are also people that are subject to their own biases. Not only just the method, it's how you read the results. And so that's one of the issues that became evident in this case is the selection process. Much of it was based on publications. But as I mentioned in the book, at the time of his death, Gaudí only had two entries in the EVRY Index of Colombia. And you cannot say that Gaudí was not a creative architect. Or Irving Gila, only one. So he was in San Diego, you know, working at the same time of Adolf Loos. So conversely, Philip Johnson, who was a media hog, had hundreds. So, but even by their own peers and his own admission, it wasn't necessarily the best architect. So that is one obvious example of the leaks in that. But that doesn't necessarily undermine the whole experiment. I don't think that.
No, but you know, it is fascinating reading the book because it does tap into that wider 50s notion that we can analyze everything, we can define everything. You know, we won World War II, we cured the Depression, we can figure out how to do things from here on. It's the American century. I mean, there was an interesting, if I remember correct, several of the people at the Institute came from the CIA or yes, the OSS.
Yes, Office of Strategic Services. So the. They used for the creativity study what was called the assessment method. And the assessment method had been used during World War II to pick individuals that would be psychologically uniquely qualified to perform highly sensitive missions under great duress. It was about effectiveness, the effective individual. Even in that case, and it was 3 days that they would come. It was in Virginia. There were some stations. Actually, then they set more stations around the world. The Nazis started this experiment in the 30s, doing this kind of a selection process. And then the Brits followed that, and someone from the American government saw what the Brits were doing and set up the unit in less than a month. So that was how fast it was. But the results were always imperfect because when first the researchers were not trained to do missions themselves, you know, they had to pick individuals based on some lab tests on stress. And then by the time they were ready to go, the mission that they were supposed to perform had already changed because the world was in evolution. So there were a lot of traumatized people that came back. And I actually asked the only survivor of the Institute of Personal Assessment and Research team, Ravenna Helson, why would you use such an imperfect method? Well, that was the only one that they had. At least it had the same error for everything. But again, They did identify certain common denominators. I don't think that the research is necessarily invalid. Right. From
next question.
So was the purpose of the study to define what creativity is, or was it to identify what are the characteristics of creative people?
In a way, both the idea was let's understand creativity through those who are hailed the most creative by the experts in their field, and let's identify what kind of educational environment and pedagogical method we can use for these individuals to have more creatives as opposed to be such a small percentage. In fact, these architects were at a great average of B minus. So they were mediocre students or average students. There was nothing that would single them out. Most of them, Neutra was a straight A, and then also Ayenpei was a straight A. But, you know, Bob Anshin was C minus. Bob Anshin designed the International Building here in San Francisco, the Sedona Chapel. I mean, he was an important architect. So that's that. And ultimately, they realized that the best environment for the creative architect, well, the creative individual, is the independent study, where you do whatever you want, and you have some kind of dialogue as opposed to a structured class. The creative person profoundly resists group work, profoundly. And so, therefore, the whole approach of Walter Gropius of teamwork was never going to fly, and it never did in reality at the level of the creative work. Production work is a different thing, but that very first moment is fundamentally individual.
Do you think there's anything about how we approach creativity today that is traced back to this IPAR, but to all these studies that sort of has become diffused in population?
I do not. I simply see IPAR did an amazing job at getting the funding and getting the people, and they did a very questionable job at the disseminating the results. One of the most prolific writers of the group was Frank Barron, who wrote a number of books on creativity, and he helped quite a bit. He masterminding the study of the creative writers, who were extremely belligerent about being subjected to this study, and yet they still came. There was Carlos Williams that came. I think that these are processes that are inherent in the human condition. They're timeless. The fact that at some point you have this desire to see things differently. I mean, this misfit between the norm and the way you think things can work. And the creativity, see, is always very precise in terms of what is for. Because you can be original being completely insane. You know, you can go on fifth and sixth and find all sorts of characters like that here in San Francisco. But you have to do this for a real problem, not an imaginary problem. And when you solve a problem in a way that has not been solved, a real problem, that is where the creativity comes in. And that solution is going to encounter tremendous resistance because it's against the norm. So there's a body of norms that puts a lid, although it creates a kind of an average quality, but puts a lid on the creative. And so therefore, creativity is a sustained effort. I mean, decades, practically, of being countercultural.
Pierluigi, you're an architect as well as a scholar of architects, mm-hmm. know a lot of architects. The passage you played us of Chermayev was fascinating, but not surprising.
No.
I'm wondering if there were any results of the study that really surprised you.
I was touched by the ideological commitment that these architects had to their work. It's clearly not about the money. Saarinen, you know, who will die a year later of that, you know, of brain tumor, you know, in a very calm way, but without an ounce of hesitation, essentially claimed the authority of the architect, the expertise of the architect, say, I'm going to listen to your problem. I'm going to incorporate your suggestion by reorganizing the environment that created the need for that change. because I have to integrate that into an organic piece of architecture. And this has nothing to do with function. There is a much bigger mission that you're doing something good for humanity. And I find that that was a touching value. All the architects were very animated. They were, you know, we didn't play this, but Henry Hill, who was a very good architect from the Bay Area, you know, there are hundreds of houses in the East Bay, beautiful. He said, we just didn't understand the client. And they started pounding. How could we not understand the client? How could we possibly let something like this happen? You know, you don't have to be so animated about it.
You can be flexible.
You can be flexible, exactly. The flexible architect. The architect that is at the mercy. It's not that the client per se is a negative component, but it's relinquishing what you do know, which is of value to the client per se. Otherwise, the client could do this him or herself.
So Pierluigi,
yeah,
you had this great glimpse into mid-century architecture and the definition of what a creative architect was. And I'm curious if in today's light, you know, as an architect and as a writer, do you think the definition of what a creative architect is has changed from that period to today?
Well, I think that at a fundamental level, it hasn't. The nature of the design and building process is a lot more crowded because we have many more demands on the building that simply just exceed our capacity to control it. But this apparatus of expert, discrete, disciplinary knowledge can only get activated by the idea of the architect. All this amazing know-how, even the structural engineer, is always reactive to the architectural idea. He or she will not be able to put all the engines in motion if there's nothing to react to. So the architect, in reality, has a position of authority because it triggered a process which otherwise remains idle. And other than that, what fascinated me, besides, you know, obviously the social world that was fascinating, is that I don't see much obsolescence in the fundamental values that architects have. I cannot imagine that someone like Stephen Hall would not be just as passionate and animated about or Dylan Scafidi or all these folks that we hear about.
How are we doing time-wise?
Thank you. Can I ask you a question that is going to sound simple, but I'm curious what the answer is. So you talked about creativity and business and how the two were kind of in a conflict, but I was wondering, were there any insights of how they actually worked together?
Well, the business is not necessarily... It wasn't an argument against business because, in fact, the IPAR also studied Irish managers. They did a study in Europe. It's that the corporations work primarily on the idea of forecasting and predictability of performance, whereas the creative has a certain amount of entropy before he or she can produce something that is substantive. There's a IPAR confirmed the phases of the creative process, which is you're handed a problem, you're going to work on the problem, and you're invariably frustrated. The problem is not coming to a solution that has any real substance. And then you retreat yourself, you go into doing some other activity, and the subconscious works. And then you have this aha moment, and you come back and you do the verification. This has happened in every single case that they looked at. But the corporate world doesn't have time to do that. I mean, how do you justify those hours in a timesheet at the end of every 2 weeks? Oh, you know, I was frustrated and started gardening. I mean, you get fired in no time. And it's not even the fault of the corporation. It's the nature of the work that we do. So the challenge is how to find the space, how to carve the space where that rumination can take place so that the process then can yield the results that ultimately will yield. And not everybody is asking for creative work. Some people are asking for competent work, and that's also a different kind of very honorable activity, incidentally.
One famous architect that came up in the book, but it wasn't part of the study, I think, was Frank Lloyd Wright. Was he not selected, or was he...
So Frank Lloyd Wright was selected. He was considered, he had the highest favor, but he never answered the, he never responded to the letter of invitation. He was also the oldest. He would have been 92 at the time, and he died shortly after. So.
Well, does anyone else have a question?
Well, let's see.
Anything, Alec?
I'll have a real quick wrap up.
Excellent.
Imagine that UC Berkeley tried to do this today, the Institute tried to do this today. Logistically and in terms of the web of media people and all, do you think this could be done today, or would the architects just not have the time or interest?
Well, it would be very, very difficult to convince people to come for that reason. They might come for socializing. But I would argue that for some people that don't need that kind of backup, people that have reached the level of Frank Gehry, Renzo Piano, I just don't think it's feasible to think that they will come
right. For
any reason. So, and I don't think that this test would work simply by having them filling online some... questionnaires, because the whole point is to see them interact with each other and deal with the issues. I mean, having the friction of personalities and how they deal with that. That's a huge part of the study.
Thanks.
And that's a great place to end. Thank you very, very much, both of you. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Pierluigi's book is available for sale afterwards. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.